This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is David Ballantyne. He is a lecturer of history at Keele University in the United Kingdom, and their academic system is a little bit different from ours. He's basically an assistant professor of history at Keele. He got his PhD from Cambridge University with a longtime friend of mine, Tony Badger, who did Southern Studies. And David's got a new book called New Politics in the Old South, Ernest F. Hollings in the Civil Rights Era. David, welcome to the Journal.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you get on to this topic? Because you're working at Cambridge now. I know Tony's into 20th century Southern politics. But how did you happen to focus on Fritz Hollings?
Well, I came about Hollings really through an interest in civil rights era black politics, actually, or after 1965. So I had done an honors dissertation looking at Doug Wilder's career in Virginia. He was the first elected black governor in the U.S., elected in 1989. And then after that, I looked at other African-American candidates for senator and governor, one of whom was Harvey Gantt. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you know, and many will, he was the mayor of Charlotte in the 1980s, but also the first person to desegregate Clemson in 1963, when Hollings had just finished his governor's term.
And so that got you into Fritz Hollings. There, as you pointed out, biographies of many people from this era. Senator Thurmond has at least a half a dozen. Mm. Two or three very good scholarly ones. But Senator Hollings didn't. I mean, maybe it's because he was the longest-serving junior senator in the history of the United States Senate, 36 years as junior senator. But he had an interesting role in the transformation of Southern politics, and that's where I'd like to kind of head the conversation. You have a very interesting quotation from Senator Richard Russell of Georgia on how to be an effective United States senator. You want to tell us what that is?
Of course. So Hollings first entered the U.S. Senate in 1966. So he won a two-year term. The former incumbent had died in office, so he didn't win a full 6 years initially. And Richard Russell from Georgia claimed that to be a good senator, you had 2 years to be a statesman, two to be a politician, and then the final 2 years of your term, you had to be a demagogue. It's a helpful dictum, I think.
And because of the way of the Senate race, and I want to go back into that, Senator Hollings started off, since he only had 2 years, his first 2 years in the Senate, instead of being a statesman, he was a demagogue.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go ahead and back up. I don't want to go back to when he was born and what have you. The fact that he did go to the Citadel and he was a group of really outstanding young men who ended up leading major roles in South Carolina's political life. Jim Mann, John West, among others. But he had a pretty fast political rise given the nature of South Carolina politics.
Well, he was part of that generation of politicians who were impacted by the Great Depression and then also military service. He initially went into law, and from there, a good way to find more clients as a lawyer with the rules against advertising your services was to run for office.
Boy, for folks these days, that's quite a change. Every billboard and bus has an attorney's advertising on it. But they could not advertise in those days.
No. So he initially ran and won office in 1948 as a state representative, but there certainly was a rapid rise. He was pretty popular among his colleagues in the early 1950s. Then he ran for lieutenant governor in 1954. And then as, I believe, the youngest governor in the 20th century in South Carolina, won election in 1958 to that office.
His rise in the House, because it's still, even though there were a large number of World War II veterans, young people, new members of the House in the late 1940s, he was kind of taken under his wing by Solomon Blott, the renowned Speaker of the House of Representatives. Not just Hollings' career, but you can look back at John West's early career. You can look back at Bob McNair's early career. Blott had a way of giving young representatives a challenging job, and if they succeeded, they became one of his boys, and he advanced them to the right committees. If they didn't succeed, they were in British parlance, they were backbenchers for the rest of their lives. And what was it he threw at Fritz and said he wanted to see passed, his very first major bill?
Well, the first major piece of legislation Hollings was looking at was schooling in South Carolina. So looking at trying to equalize these apparently separate but equal schools, but which were in fact greatly underfunded on the black side.
Yes, the idea of they were separate, but there was no equal was not even close. Mm. So it's going to cost money. And what Burns really was looking at was bricks and mortar, as they would say today, because some of the schools, and Hollings actually visited one in Charleston County, that not only was the rural black school in the Charleston district incredibly bad, so were the rural white schools. But anyway, it's going to take a sales tax. And South Carolina did not have a sales tax. We don't like taxes in this state for the most part. But Fritz Hollings authored the bill and shepherded it through the House.
It's a running theme in his career as well, seeing a political office as a way of pushing policies rather than simply a means to further political office. So pushing through this sales tax in the early 1950s, much as when he becomes governor in 1959, there's another tax passed to allow the state to balance its budget and then present itself as a more attractive destination for new industries to come to the state.
And because he was successful, as I said, he became one of the speaker's boys. He was majority leader, but then he moves up to be lieutenant governor. Let's talk about that lieutenant gubernatorial campaign, because he wasn't unopposed.
No, he wasn't. He ran against a politician called Clayter Arents. And this was a time just after the handing down of Brown v. Board of Education, which was the decision that ruled that segregated public schooling by race was unconstitutional. And that played a major role in how the campaign shook out.
All right. And let's talk about how that campaign shook out. Was Hollings campaigning for the, you know, supporting the Brown decision?
Certainly not. Almost all Southern politicians opposed it at this time, certainly in South Carolina. Hollings spoke about the Brown decision making racial issues pure fire and brimstone in the mid-1950s. So while the lieutenant governor's race, like today, is certainly less high profile than who's campaigning for governor or senator at the time, both he and Arents opposed the Brown decision.
For people who think of the later Hollings as almost the poster boy for a progressive white Southern politician, it's a pretty dark picture. He said some pretty awful things.
I think the 1950s, it's a time in Southern politics where the more liberal politicians on race tended to go silent or support massive resistance to civil rights change. So Hollings, early in his career, while he had shown some openness on race, as with his advocacy of the sales tax to help equalize schools, and also his support for having African Americans appointed to local boards, he certainly went along with this massive resistance politics, even though you could say he wasn't necessarily the most extreme of these politicians doing it.
From the beginning, Fritz Hollings was always good for a soundbite, or quote, but while serving as a member of the Charleston House delegation, in 1952, he nominated an African-American to serve on the Charleston School Board. It didn't happen. The local NAACP was right appreciative. But he later said, it was simply a matter of representation. Everybody was represented. There was a Jew, a Catholic, a Lutheran, and a Greek member. Everybody had a slot on the board but the blacks. That's not exactly a progressive statement.
Certainly not. There's a good deal of conjecture in how you try and interpret politicians' early careers in light of what they do later. If we'd cut off looking at South Carolina history in early 1948, for instance, we might think of Strom Thurmond as this progressive governor who was trying to modernize the state and maybe would have taken a more liberal position on civil rights in the 1950s and on. But that doesn't happen. You know, Thurmond instead runs for president as a Dixiecrat, so this breakaway third party movement, and then sets out his career as one of the most vocal opponents of civil rights laws in the United States. So it is very difficult to sort of pick up signs of either openness or reactionary sentiment by taking a snapshot, I think.
But as a historian, David, don't you think it's, I mean, you're presenting a full picture of the man's career, and yes, he did change. A lot of times, particularly today, and I'm not speaking of Senator Hollings, but folks seem to forget what they said or did, not just 20 years ago, but yesterday. they changed their position and send out another press release. I've always known, since I've been in the state, that Fritz Hollings was a brash person. He said what was on his mind, also a wit that sometimes got him into trouble. But he also was a pretty gutsy guy. And running for lieutenant governor in 1954, there's a story which you recount. It wasn't just Clayton Arents who was going to put his name in the ring. Burnett Maybank Jr., the son of the United States Senator, was also thinking about running for lieutenant governor. Now, how did Fritz head that off?
Hollings, in this case, instead of choosing to run and probably lose against Burnett Maybank Jr., the son of a sitting senator who would have much greater name recognition than he did, instead of that, Hollings went to speak to Maybank Sr. and announced that he was in fact going to run for the U.S. Senate. So he wanted just to be beaten by the real Maybank instead of giving up easily and just waiting his turn.
I just think it's a typical Fritz quote. I might as well get beat first class, not waste all that time and effort. But in terms of politicians' name recognition, it's interesting that the senior Maybank maybe talked his son out of running. But anyway, he did not run, so it was running against Clayton Arents. And Hollings and Arents almost tried to see who could be the most opposed to Brown and the idea of desegregating schools.
Absolutely. This isn't really a very uplifting time to look back at Southern politics, especially politics in South Carolina or Alabama or Mississippi. This is a time where it's politically viable and advantageous to take this most extreme anti-Brown position.
That was an interesting campaign year because the man who was elected governor, Governor Timmerman, had a weird solution to the desegregation issue. He proposed a triple school system for the state, not just dual, black and white. We're going to have one for white, one for blacks, and one for those who wanted to be integrated.
And, I mean, that was willfully misinterpreted by his opponent as well, as suggesting that Timmerman, a major civil rights opponent in his career, was in fact advocating school integration because of this third system.
Yeah. Well, very quickly, opposition to desegregation became associated with communism. And you point that out very, very vividly. You might give some examples.
Well, again, this is a running theme in Southern political life from at least the 1940s and 50s onwards. So Timmerman, as governor, viewed many threats to segregation as also communistic threats. And one of these major occasions where this occurred was when Clemson College had provisionally accepted a major grant of money from the Atomic Energy Commission. But to accept the money, the college also had to accept a non-discrimination clause. So that would be to not discriminate against admissions on the basis of race, creed, or color. And so Timmerman, when he found out about this, was wholly opposed to this and pressured the board at Clemson to return the grant. And he argued that by including the word creed in this stipulation for accepting the money, that in fact that could allow a communist to gain access to it.
That's a very interesting interpretation of the word creed.
It is. You could argue many Southern politicians certainly believed strongly in this communistic threat that communists favor racial equality, so do civil rights activists. Therefore, civil rights activism is a communistic threat. But as you just highlighted, often it is difficult to distinguish whether people are truly opposed to this apparent threat of communism or whether communism is simply, you know, another tool with which to beat civil rights advocates.
If you play the red card, as it was, you don't have to play the race card. Mm. It's a more genteel, patriotic way of dealing with the problem. And the problem in the 1950s after the Brown decision was throughout the American South, white resistance. This is part of the story, too, and you might want to talk about that just very briefly.
I'm encouraged by politicians in southern states. There is after the Brown decision in 1954, and then the Brown II decision in 1955, which just provided the parameters for desegregating schools. So this was to be done with all deliberate speed. Mm-hmm. Not immediately, not quickly, but many Southern politicians, in fact, interpreted all deliberate speed to be do nothing.
Yes, the old 12th of never. Even with Brown II, there still was organized resistance by the white community, particularly what we'd call the leadership of the community, not resorting to the Klan, but the white citizens' councils.
Yes. Again, this is what you could see as a more genteel form of civil rights resistance. But citizens' councils tended to use economic means to try and force civil rights activists to abandon their work. So rather than burning a cross on the lawn, you'd simply publish the names of people who are trying to petition to have integrated schools. And conveniently, those people would lose their lines of credit or be unable to get a loan.
Or they lost their, they were renting their house. Mm. And I guess one of the most famous of those, the squeeze is what they called it, was in Orangeburg, which resulted in a counter boycott that was effective.
Yes. So these economic boycotts led by influential, economically powerful whites at times, as in Orangeburg, led to counter-protests or counter-boycotting, which backfired as in many parts of South Carolina, in many rural areas of the state, the black population was large enough to make, you know, the loss of black business a really significant economic problem for local white-owned businesses.
That story continues. The white citizens' councils continue, very carefully monitored by the state government, particularly once Fritz Hollings gets to be governor. One of the interesting things about his lieutenant governorship is this is the time when particularly southern states are recruiting outside industry. But George Bell Timmerman didn't like to travel. And so Lieutenant Governor Hollings was making all of these business trips.
Hollings, as a much younger man and much more energetic politician, picked up some of the slack where Timmerman was not traveling outside of the state to try and encourage industries to relocate in South Carolina.
I think Timmerman's position was, if they want to come here and want something in terms of special legislation and what have you, they can come to me, to my office. In other words, he wasn't going to be selling. He expected them to pay court to him.
Absolutely. It wasn't the case that he was unfriendly to these businesses who would want to locate. And in fact, on one occasion, he called a special session of the General Assembly to pass laws favorable to a major paper company to allow them to come.
Bowater.
Yes, Bowater.
A British company. Because until the Alien Land Act, if you can call it that, it forbid foreign corporations or individuals from owning more than a certain amount of acreage. And, of course, Bowater wanted timber company, you know, timber land and what have you. And as you say, Governor Timmerman called a special session. They got that all changed, and then Bowater could very happily come into South Carolina.
Yes. But with Hollings, he certainly represents a generational change here. He is one of this younger group of politicians who are more likely to travel elsewhere and try and actively court industries to come to South Carolina and increase payrolls.
Throughout his career, even people who did not particularly care for Fritz talked about he never met a stranger. He was loquacious. Mm-hmm. He could, as they say up north, he could schmooze with the best of them. And that was part of his success. he seemed to be able to gauge his audience and tell the Northern businessmen and industrialists exactly what they wanted to hear.
Actually, as governor, somewhat later, he tried to take cues from North Carolina's industrialization efforts, which had been a regional pace setter. And as the governor at the time there in North Carolina was Governor Hodges, Hollings recounts having deliberately mispronounced his name at times to get a hearing with these businesses. So rather than, you know, Governor Hollings from South Carolina, it's Governor Hollings from Carolina. And if you say it quickly and indistinctly enough, with a distinctive accent, people may get it wrong.
Again, clever. And he didn't mind that he was being a little, you know, the odor of mendacity didn't bother him too much. In his own way, saying he was Governor Hollings from South or from Carolina, just mumbling, as you say. But with Fritz's brogue, he could have been saying almost anything. But he said it with a smile.
And you get an audience.
Yes. And, of course, once he became governor, 1958, he made industrial recruitment his major thrust. But when he announced for the governorship in January 58, he said, and I'm quoting from your book now, "Our greatest problem is segregation. During my time in public office, absolute segregation has been maintained in the schools, and let me state now that as long as I am governor, they will continue to remain segregated." So he ran for governor of South Carolina as an out-and-out segregationist.
Everyone who was a viable candidate, certainly in the Deep South in the 1950s, offered fairly similar views, either silence or denunciation of Brown and this demand to desegregate public schooling. And of course, many made quick backtracking decisions in the mid-1960s once absolute segregation became impossible to maintain.
And then, of course, after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, he certainly began to walk a tightrope between his very strong white working class base and a new large African American voting base. Now, he won the governorship in a runoff, one of a number of times he and Donald Russell tangled. There were a number of candidates in 1958, and it got to be a pretty nasty race. And one of the people accused Hollings of being the bottle baby of the Barnwell Ring, so-called Barnwell Ring, the politician Edgar Brown and Saul Blott. Winchester Smith was the third one. But it didn't make any difference. He won 57% or more of the vote in the runoff, and he is inaugurated. And really, David, you have captured the whole essence of defining a moderate white politician in the South with this chapter heading, Segregation with Dignity, which of course comes from a Saturday Evening Post article, which actually was talking about what happened at Clemson.
Yes, and the Saturday Evening Post article was published in early 1963, so just after Clemson had admitted Harvey Gantt. But that was talking about integration with dignity. But throughout his governorship, Hollings focused on preserving order rather than considering the rightness or wrongness of civil rights demands, and saw his response in preventing violence primarily as a dignified approach to civil rights troubles.
So in terms of law and order, which is part of his famous remarks in 1963, law and order meant not just the Bull Connor fire hoses, police dogs. It was to prevent violence. And I'd heard this story many times, but you point it and you've got the footnotes. All of the Klan chapters, they had SLED agents in them. White Citizens Council had SLED. The whole idea was to not have another Little Rock.
So the main goal here is to avoid a violent confrontation that would give civil rights activists a photo opportunity or a chance to highlight the injustices of a segregated society, as it was possible to do at Little Rock or in Birmingham, Alabama, for instance.
And there were civil rights demonstrations going on in South Carolina now, sit-ins and what have you. And there were arrests made. Ida Quincy Newman and others, very active NAACP. But how did he, when there were arrests made, how did he avoid having photo ops for the evening news?
One of the things Hollings did was try to ensure that local police forces were supplemented with SLED agents who were more likely to not behave violently towards protesters, but also, where possible, to bring in black police officers as well. And he spoke in later interviews in the 1980s about efforts of SCLC, so Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Martin Luther King's organization, how they had tried to come over to Rock Hill in South Carolina and protest. But to face this off, he brought in black police officers to do the arresting of these protesters. And so that did not provide the necessary contrast between apparently unjust, white, racist law enforcement and righteous civil rights protesters.
Your primary sources are rich. You've got not just the interviews with Senator Hollings, but everybody else from that generation, political figures, journalists, the modern political collections at the university are very rich. But again, I found the incident you just described and the way he told it, that's typical Fritz Hollings. He said, I got as many blacks out there as I could. I took the blacks off the force in Charleston, Columbia State College security in Orangeburg, and I had black police officers on the streets. So when they came in, there would be a black officer apprehending a black, and so they threw the cameras away. Pretty cynical.
Certainly cynical. This is the double-edged approach of this apparent moderation, or what passes for political moderation on race in the early 1960s. So this concern with order rather than justice, Martin Luther King later denounced among white politicians, this concern for order also meant a lack of concern for protesters' demands.
All right. David, we need to pause a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. David Ballantyne, who's written a book about Fritz Hollings and the evolution of a moderate Southern white politician. Among the folks that you read her interview, Alice Spearman pointed out that she was on the Human Relations Council and involved very actively in the civil rights movement, that Hollings was the first Southern governor to send out highway patrolmen to protect civil rights demonstrators. Now, as you pointed out, it wasn't because he believed in what they were doing. He just didn't want any problems, right?
Yes. Although I should say it is difficult to know exactly what people are thinking at different points. But he certainly was trying to avoid racial violence. And a good way to do that is to ensure that protests and demonstrations are policed. Mm-hmm. But that differed him from, for instance, the Alabama governor at the same time, not George Wallace, but the politician who out-segged him, mm-hmm. Governor Patterson, who claimed that should there be a push for integration there, he'd be one of the first to be pushing for rioting.
Or Ross Barnett in Mississippi, or Orville Faubus in Arkansas. I mean, you can just go down the list of Southern governors. But let's talk about what he accomplished as governor. Again, there's so many tales, but in his memoirs or his recordings, he said these are the people, they were part of his team, and I think it's particularly interesting depending on if you know about the later history of these individuals. I had a house team, and this is Hollings talking, Bob McNair, Floyd Spence, and Rex Carter. All right, Bob McNair becomes governor eventually. Floyd Spence becomes a congressman. Rex Carter ends up being Speaker of the House, succeeding Solomon Blood. And in the Senate, I had John West, Marshall Parker, and Billy Goldberg. John West, of course, would become governor. Parker would then become Hollings' opponent in two Senate races. Spence became a Republican. And Steve Griffith from Newberry County, I know Steve, he is very much a Republican today, but he remembers Fritz as a governor And he actually used the term schmooze, that would schmooze with us, invite you to the governor's mansion for a drink. This is a man who knows how to get things done.
Throughout his career, he's concerned with the more personable side of politics, or suddenly views politics as, while a dirty profession, one that, you know, should you do it well, there are good outcomes to be made from it, which in this case, you know, schmoozing state legislators would mean that you could then get your agenda passed more easily.
Well, and of course, being the legislative state, you had to have an effective legislative team. Among the things he did was he really got the State Development Board beefed up, hired away a lot of Luther Hodges experts from North Carolina. These were big budget items in South Carolina, and he could get it.
Yes, thanks partly to this schmoozing. The State Development Board, which is this body tasked with attracting new industries from elsewhere in the country and even further afield, its membership was greatly expanded. And to avoid claims of sort of local favoritism, there would be members from every part of the state and then others at large. But it also had a much larger budget. So thanks to a good relationship with the General Assembly and state legislators, he was able to get measures like this expanded State Development Board passed.
And the technical college system, or the tech schools as they were in those days.
The tech schools were one of his major pet projects, which soon were imitated in other southern states. But it was a way to provide businesses a chance to, as he claimed, start up in the black when they arrived on location in South Carolina, because the state government would subsidize training for workers.
And actually do things like set up a model of whatever the, I don't want to say assembly line, but for whatever that particular company was going to manufacture, the students would actually be trained to do that, not just a general training of some kind. The origins of that tech system, at least the legislation, is part of the Hollings mythology, if we will. Are you familiar with that?
I am. In order to get any appropriation for this measure passed, Hollings, with the help of a bottle of bourbon, discussed the matter into the night with Edgar Brown.
Yes.
Another leading state politician.
Yes, yes, the key man in the state senate. Yes, they drank the bottle of bourbon and supposedly, on the back of an envelope, Senator Brown made his notes, and that was the basis for the legislation for the tech system. It's hard to imagine things like that happening today. Maybe it does, but this was a colorful era, particularly beginning with Fritz Hollings. Things are starting to change. David, I could probably stay dealing with the governorship in that history because it's a fascinating period in our state's history. But we need to move on into the Senate. Why don't you just give us your overview to begin with, and then we'll get some detail about Fritz Hollings as a United States senator.
Well, Hollings first won election in 1966 for a two-year term, won re-election in 1968 for the full 6 years, and then another 30 years after that. So he was there until 2005 when he finally retired.
And it was only for the last 5 years that he was the senior senator.
Very briefly in his time, only once Strom Thurmond had, you know, at the age of 100 left, did he, you know, make it to senior senator there.
Well, his run for the Senate was not the first time. He once ran again after he left the governorship. He ran against Olin D. Johnson, got his clock cleaned pretty well. And there were rumors that he was thinking of run for governor. But then Olin D. Johnson dies.
Olin D. Johnson died. And at the time, Donald Russell, who Hollings had beaten in 1958 for the governorship, was in fact partway through his own governor's term. But Russell appointed himself to Johnston's unexpired term.
Yeah, he did. He resigned the governorship, and then Lieutenant Governor McNair becomes Governor McNair, and he appoints Russell without any consultation with the Johnston family. Then, and that becomes a lot of bitterness, which ends up affecting that race because Russell's there for 2 years, but he has to run at the next election to be reelected to the term. And what did Fritz do? What was his major thing that he hammered about Russell?
Hollings called Russell a dropout governor, which for somebody who is so highly educated as Russell was, a former president of USC, may seem slightly ironic. But Russell faced this charge of having self-appointed, even though McNair technically, once he became governor, appointed Russell to the Senate. Hollings also made up quickly with Johnston's family, which is very important, as Olin Johnston was a hugely successful politician in South Carolina. He was the only person to beat Strom Thurmond in an election. So he had lots of friends and supporters throughout the state.
Johnston, in effect, really had a machine. He had built up patronage as chairman of the post office committee, and you couldn't go into a small town in South Carolina without somebody either owing his or her job to him or their uncle did. That plus the textile worker base. Olin D. Johnston was one of them. He was proud to call himself a linthead.
Yes, Johnston was one of these last New Deal liberals. So he proudly supported unions, which is now would seem very unusual for a South Carolina politician, especially a successful South Carolina politician. But you know, he had this background as a textile worker himself and commanded great support, especially in the upstate where textiles particularly dominated.
And so when this election came about in 66, the Johnston family let it be known that they were going to support Fritz Hollings. And that made a difference. And then Fritz got cocky coming into the general election.
He certainly did. This was a time when two-party competition in terms of Republican versus Democrat in South Carolina was only just getting underway. And Hollings certainly underestimated what would be necessary to win in November after having won the primary against a Democrat. So he recalled later this having been quite a stale general election campaign, where he ran against Marshall Parker.
His old friend.
His old friend. And old friend of Hollings's first administrative assistant, Crawford Cook. Hollings didn't really adapt very well in this general election setting and came very close to losing. Also, this is a difficult time nationally to be a Democrat in that in South Carolina, Lyndon Johnson is unpopular. He's helped push through the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and there's also Vietnam and the apparent mismanagement or lack of evident progress in Vietnam, at least, which is becoming a major concern in 1966 in elections across the country.
Well, Hollings wins in 66. He takes Russell's advice and is a demagogue for 2 years. But one of his major drumbeats is the management or mismanagement of the Vietnam War. And, of course, the command of American forces in Vietnam happens to be a South Carolinian, William Westmoreland. So when Fritz runs for re-election in 68, he doesn't go to the Democratic National Convention.
No, he doesn't. This is a very cagey time in politics, for Hollings, certainly. So in 1968, there are three candidates for the presidency, or at least three major candidates. So Richard Nixon on the Republican side, Hubert Humphrey for the Democrats, and George Wallace, this third-party Democratic Alabama, former Alabama governor, who really was campaigning in a cleaned-up version of his segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever mode. So Hollings avoided the Democratic National Convention, which is fortunate, as he avoided association with clashes between anti-war protesters and police in Chicago. And he also stated that he personally supported Humphrey, but he wasn't trying to tell other people how to vote. This is a running problem, certainly for Southern Democrats in subsequent years, in having presidential nominees who most of the state's voters are unlikely to vote for. So he performs a similar act with George McGovern, who runs in 1972 as well.
But he does support Jimmy Carter.
He does.
Who was the last Democrat to carry South Carolina back in 1976. But sometimes the newspapers in South Carolina would say Fritz was out of touch. But then as it came time for campaigning, he always knew what to say and how to do it. And you point out one of the most unusual tie-ins he had, officially or unofficially, was with Roger Milliken, the Daddy Warbucks of the South Carolina Republican Party. But what was the issue that Milliken and Hollings agreed on completely?
The major issue there is textile imports. So while talking about foreign trade and its apparent dangers to the U.S. economy, it became very prominent in 2015 and 16. Hollings was beating the drum about this for decades. Textiles were South Carolina's largest manufacturer when he got into politics. And he saw the loss of jobs overseas to areas of the world with lower wages as hugely detrimental to the South Carolina economy. And there he agreed with Milliken.
And as you point out, there's no documentary proof, but I can tell you the word was for years unofficially that Milliken put out the word that Fritz was okay.
As I heard it, he finally cut a check to the Hollings campaign in Hollings' final election, so 1998. But previously, it's just tacit approval.
Mm-hmm. But that made a difference. That made a difference because Hollings never had a serious competitor until that last election. Hollings did change over the years from his law and order view on the racial issue. Jack Bass, Dan Carter, other writers about the American South hold Hollings up as a Southern progressive. Just briefly kind of chronicle his change from 1963, his farewell speech, which was basically a law and order speech, to a Southern progressive in the 1970s and certainly the 1980s.
In 1963, as we said earlier, he called for the state's politicians and the state to accept desegregation peacefully at Clemson. He then left office. He had been a Kennedy supporter in 1960, which angered many South Carolinians, Kennedy only carrying the state narrowly, and continued to do so. On terms of race, when he came to the Senate again in 1966, rather than supporting more civil rights legislation or even the confirmation of the first African-American Supreme Court Justice, Thurgood Marshall, he instead campaigned for African-American votes quite covertly, but he emphasized his support for pocketbook issues. So economic advancement, the Head Start program, which he supported, was one of these new mid-1960s measures. Also, he helped some rural communities gain the funds required to have a food stamp program in their counties.
And then, of course, there was his famous poverty campaign.
Yes. Once he won re-election in 1968, he conducted poverty tours in South Carolina, which is very unusual for a U.S. senator to do in their own backyard. So he highlighted the prevalence of domestic hunger and malnutrition in Beaufort and Jasper counties particularly. And from there, he went to speak to Senate committees as a star witness to give proof about this prevalence of domestic hunger. He then became a vocal advocate for a much expanded food stamp program, which many associated with black advancement. He argued that to do so was actually fiscally conservative because it would save money if you fed people in early life, that you would then have to spend in greater amounts to incarcerate them later. But he also claimed that feeding hungry people would prevent revolutionary ideologies from getting more following in the United States.
Yeah, many of his arguments he frames constitutionally, legally, including times when he bucked his own party on Supreme Court nominees. Mm. This is how he supports poverty programs, but then he opposes Thurgood Marshall. He opposes Abe Fortas. So he really is walking a political tightrope here.
Yes, he is. There's suddenly a great deal of fence straddling that successful Southern Democrats like Hollings do at this time. And with this opposition to liberal Supreme Court justices, that's particularly apparent in his first 2-year term. later in his 1969 to 75 term, he similarly supports the principle of integrated schooling, but he opposes the main means for bringing that about, which is school busing. So that's a fairly common position, but it also shows this troubled accommodation between black interests and the concerns of most of his white constituents who, while they may have supported integrated public education, thought of busing as being an unwanted intrusion.
And the irony, of course, is that busing of students became, under Jimmy Burns, almost doubled.
That is certainly an irony, where busing by the late 1960s and early 1970s is seen as a means of integrating schools. But the governor in the early 1950s, Jimmy Burns, in fact boasted about the extent of busing that was going on in South Carolina and seeing it as a sign of a modern school system, having these buses being used to bus white students to better white schools. And in fact, the case that became rolled into the Brown case, Briggs v. Elliott, started out over a demand from black parents in Clarendon County to have school buses for their children as well.
There are ironies abound in South Carolina history. Sometimes Hollings said things that today would not be considered politically correct. Among Hollings's quotes, this was after the Kennedy election, which Kennedy won, barely carried the state. Fritz tells this on himself. After Kennedy told Hollings he was going to appoint Soapy Williams, who was the extremely liberal governor of Michigan, to Africa as a special ambassador, Hollings claimed that he told Kennedy, "We could have carried South Carolina by a landslide if he had known that." Anyway, have you got a favorite Hollings story?
I quite like how, well, running against in 1986, Hollings was running for re-election to the Senate again, and in a debate against his Republican opponent, you may now know him,
Governor
McMaster, McMaster asked whether Hollings would take a drug test, and Hollings quickly replied that he would, provided McMaster took an IQ test.
And actually, Governor McMaster has told that story on himself in recent years, but at the time, it was that fast comeback. That, and also, what about the Dan Rather story?
When Hollings had gone on an interview to talk about the dangers of textile imports, he was wearing, allegedly, a Korean suit at the time, and he was being interviewed by Sam Donaldson, who wore a toupee. Donaldson pressed him on where his suit was from, and quickly, again, showing this acid wit, Hollings replied that if Donaldson wanted to personalize it, he got the suit right down the road from where Donaldson got his wig. And he wasn't invited back.
Okay, David, I think we could go on, but why don't you just kind of wrap things up? Because again, one of your chapter titles might say it all: a common sense, realistic South Carolina Democrat.
Certainly, that's the way Hollings tried to and successfully presented himself as a politician. He made these troubled and small accommodations in the 1960s and early 70s on race with African-American constituents. But he did emerge as a fairly moderate politician by the early 1970s, as a forerunner of politicians like Jimmy Carter. Although he wasn't a New Deal liberal, he didn't see government doing huge things. He thought that government had a role to play in improving people's lives. And so he was very different in his thinking from modern anti-government strains in politics.
I mean, he really believed that government could be made to work.
Certainly. And when he wrote a memoir, he in fact called it Making Government Work. So Hollings, although there is this baggage, as with all of these Southern politicians who come from the civil rights and pre-civil rights eras, he is a policy-oriented politician. Like, we haven't spoken about it today, but he was involved in environmental preservation efforts as well. Or you could write a book about Hollings and the budget, or Hollings and campaign finance reform. So there are a lot of ways that you could look at Hollings's career. I've chosen to look primarily at his emergence from this one-party segregationist Democratic Party in the 1950s and 60s to this more New South Democratic, more friendly to racial minorities mindset from the late 60s and early 70s. And in this, he's successful. He develops a personal constituency that re-elects him for decades in South Carolina to the point where when he retires, he is the last high-profile Democrat in the state. And now, 12 years later, it doesn't seem especially close that South Carolina is going to be electing Democrats for governor or senator anytime soon.
It's been a sea change in South Carolina politics, and you chronicle that change beautifully. David Ballantyne, the author of New Politics in the Old South, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you for having me.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It's interesting to have a young faculty member from the United Kingdom studying not just the American South, but in particular South Carolina. But the depth and the research that David Ballantyne put into this book, this is really the evolution of not just Senator Ernest Hollings, but also of Southern politics. It's nicely written. There are some wonderful anecdotes in it. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.